As a custodian determined by the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences, I declare the defense of dissertation of Konstantinos Bitsas, Cambridge Classics in the History of Ideas, Main Studies and Commitments of the Method in the works of Quentin Skinner and John Donne, open.
Esteemed custos, honored opponent, ladies and gentlemen, may I be allowed to provide you today with a brief discussion of the research that I have delivered as my doctoral dissertation at the Generous Department of Social Sciences and Philosophy of the University of Jyväskylä. This inquiry has consisted in a close examination of a substantial part of the work of some of the founding figures of the said Cambridge School of Intellectual History, and it reflects my study of the topic for a handful of years. In this presentation, I will follow more or less the basic structure of my dissertation text. This means that I will begin with a short discussion of my introductory chapter. Following this, I will move into my first main chapter, which investigates Professor Skinner's work on the history of the concept of the state. Next, I will move to my second main chapter, which discusses Professor Donne's work on democracy and its history. And in the end, I will give you a short picture of my general conclusion. As far as my most elementary level of introduction is concerned, which I have tried to address to the wider possible audience, I have chosen to make an appeal to the academic designation of conceptual history as a broad label that enjoys a level of currency that is wide enough in order to appeal to the largest possible range of colleagues that can be interested in this kind of approach that is usually summarized under this term. For this reason, I take conceptual history to count more or less as an interdisciplinary exercise that brings together sources and method that have been traditionally reserved mostly for elaborations that originate from the more established disciplines of philosophy, history, the study of politics, and the social sciences. In this respect, I take the Cambridge School in the history of political thought and the history of ideas to be probably the most influential intellectual movement in this series, and therefore my main aim in this dissertation has been to provide a closer study of the founding figures of the Cambridge School as the classics of the kind, having principally in mind the work of such historians of political thought as John Pocock, Quentin Skinner and John Donne. This means that I mostly insist on matters that we usually summarize as having to do with method, and this is why the first part of my introduction discusses how I conceive of method and how I use it throughout this dissertation, whereas the second part of the introduction moves to a brief description of the original making of the Cambridge School. As far as method is concerned, I begin with a brief overview of the recorded range of senses of methodos and method in the authoritative dictionaries of the history of the ancient Greek and the English language, which gives me quite much from the beginning a hard to separate coexistence of a conception of a named destination, which is more or less included in the original component of odos, which stands for meanings such as those that we usually associate with way or path, and the conception of an interest to bring this path to a destination into some quite visible effect, which is implied more or less in the meta prefix. In this respect, the succession of the different ways in which method has been used throughout the times reveals the ongoing shifts between the adherence to already found methods as well as the elaborations of new methods in the process, to the eventual point of a late interest in what is usually called as methodology, which appears in the last two centuries. In this respect, I have tried in what concerns my own research to keep up a similar differentiation between two separate meanings of method, with the first of them consisting in what I call the received method, which allows me to emphasize the use of the examined authors, earlier settings and earlier ideas, whereas with what I designate as the method at work, I try to keep up to our attention what I take to be the more individual features of quality in the examined author's own work. And in order to reach this quite demanding level of detail, I have primarily focused upon the comparative evolution of a defined portion of the author's historical inquiries on a single concept of idea, which for Professor Skinner's case has been that of the state, and for Professor Dunn's case has been that of democracy. However, in order to capture some further interesting aspects of what I take to be crucial from the point of view of method, I have also utilized some further devices, which come above all out of Max Weber's highly sanctioned work on the methodology of the social sciences, whereas I have also tried to keep up more or less a biographical perspective in the way I build the narrative as my chapters go by, and I have also went over to identify the different levels of influence that various more individual contexts have had in the process. In what has to do with the identification of such contexts, I found best to provide some more general context that led to the eventual establishment of what we nowadays identify as the Cambridge School, by providing a brief overview of the making of the school in the institution and beyond, which takes us originally in the 1870s, which was the time when a political science was first introduced in Cambridge by John Seeley and Henry Fitchwick through the offering of a new historical tripos, which included also a strong emphasis on political philosophy. In the next 5 decades, what we see out of the work of the most distinguished scholars of its generation, we can identify that history has been earning some growing ground among the scholars, whereas starting from the 1930s and most crucially from the 1940s also, we have seen that the next two generations have brought back what this new emphasis on history has been leaving behind, meaning theory, politics, and the usage of comparisons. This is where we also find Laslett's Philosophy, Politics and Society series, which was initiated in 1956, as bringing the different Anglophone authors of relevance to such issue together, which quite crucially for our own case has included the young Pocock, as well as the even younger Cambridge peers, Quentin Skinner and John Donne. The next step that takes us to the original appearance of the school takes place with Skinner's publication of his article Meaning and Understanding in the History of Ideas in 1969, which creates a debate by itself, with Pocock and Dunn siding the cause, until the eventual publication of Pocock's Machiavellian Moment and Skinner's Foundations of Modern Political Thought in the 1970s, which established a firm base for the Cambridge School beyond substantial challenges. As far as Quentin Skinner's analytical work is concerned, I have chosen to focus from a biographical point of view on a period that starts right after the publication of the Foundations and reaches until Skinner's present-day texts, since this was the period in which Skinner started providing some more focused publications on the very history of the concept or the idea of the state. And for this reason, I have sought to identify the different institutional allegiances that can help us explain the different choices behind Skinner's work as the years go by. As for the more particular methodological devices that I have used in this chapter, this had to do with the identification of the special logic in Skinner's working with his different sources, as well as in the identification of further clues and gaps that reveal additional features of interest in the text from the point of view of the author's method. As far as the internal division of my investigation in this chapter is concerned, I have chosen to be rather chronological in what has to do with the different sources that Skinner has been using, since this has been the most convenient way to see what changes as we move from the one text to the other. As far as my conclusions out of working in this chapter are concerned, I begin from what I take to be a rather methodological level of reflection, for which case I remarked that Skinner's paying attention to the study of particular contexts has led to an upgraded emphasis to minor authors and texts in political philosophy and the history of ideas, which has eventually led to the transformation of these two research areas into the history of political thought and what we effectively count as conceptual history. In this respect, and against this background, I have recommended for a possible need for a more consistent emphasis on tried research practices and perspectives originating in the social sciences and what we conventionally count as philosophy, such as Skinner has occasionally done from time to time in his different works, as we can see by his appeals to Max Weber, to Machiavelli, and to Collingwood, among many other names. Turning these reflections on a disciplinary level, Skinner's work reveals the usage of history as a powerful instrument for providing criticism to ongoing trends of philosophy and political theory. And against this background, I have recommended for some clearer emphasis on the dues and the roles of history, philosophy, and the other human sciences in the process, such as perhaps getting a little more clearer on what has to do with considerations regarding the status of the philosophical canon in this process, what role interpretation can have when we work in this way, as well as some more general reflections concerning the applicability of Skinner's approach beyond the study of strictly political issues and the place that other varieties of academic history can have in such a broadening. Moving all these reflections to the level of what I call the sociopolitical implications that one can identify out of Skinner's work, we can say that Skinner has led to the recovery of past heritages to our contemporary consciousness, such as the heritage of republicanism and several neglected advocacies of liberty, against which background I have recommended for the need to avoid the irreconcilability of a narrow eclecticism of insights by paying attention to the assessment of the particular weights of each case. As far as Professor Stan's work on democracy and its history is concerned, this time I have covered more or less the entire biographical trajectory of Dan's career, and this is so because I have also included a brief description of Dan's early work on Locke, which I take to be pivotal for the way he has later sought to work on the topic of the history of the idea of democracy. In this respect, my internal division in this chapter has been more straightforwardly biographical, since it had to show the dependence of the later research upon Locke, whereas some of the more individual methodological devices that I have used in this process had to do again with the identification of the special logic in Dan's work by means of a focus on what would be in Weber's terms the one-sided viewpoints and the values that can be discerned and which are further reworked as we move from one text to another. As for my conclusions from this chapter, starting from the methodological level, I have noticed that Dan has given us a strict empirical grounding of the examined cases, which has taken shape through his concernment with the overall coherence of the offered account next to the strive for historical accuracy, as this has eventually been expressed with the provisions of what Dan calls the conclusions in various pieces that he has delivered, as well as to his turn to the outlook of story in his late works. Whereas it is also worth pointing out that the way Professor Dan has been working in these texts has made it easy for him to gradually expand his reach of references on a rather global scale. My recommendations at this point have to do with the need to strengthen the clarity of the offered accounts by attending to Locke's advice for the avoidance of what Locke was calling the abuse of words, and by thinking of the individual cases from a more comparative perspective. Turning this to a disciplinary level, Dan has given us a modest mediation between history, the study of politics, and philosophy, which has been mostly based on his early recovery of the effortful character of thinking, and has led Dan to adopt a rather moderate tone on the acknowledged individuals that he has been studying, as well as to elevate the biographical approach in his works and to acknowledge the grave failures that are implicated in the topics of this kind. Upon this background, I have recommended for drawing some further resources for seeing shared grounds that already exist between the different disciplines, in tested combinations from the recent past, such as those that we find in the works of John Stuart Mill and Max Weber. Turning this next to the socio-political level, I have noticed that Dan has been forging an esteemed background for our intellectual landscape, which has been highlighting both failures and the open-ending horizon of relevant ventures, such as democracy, which is examined here in fuller detail, whereas Dan has also been mindful to keep up for strengthening the advancement of the place and role of individual judgment and as well as an invitation for us to get more active in considering our seats of trust in our contemporary predicament. Against this background, I have recommended foreseeing some further possibilities of increasing these similarly shared grounds by attending to democracy's more individual components, such as the exploration of the histories and potencies of assemblies and parliaments. Attending finally to my general conclusion, in which I have sought to provide a more overall appreciation of the Cambridge School, for which reason I had to bring Pocock back to the picture. I have begun again from the methodological level, in which we see that Pocock's elaborations of the concepts of implications and political languages have turned the attention to the formative role of words and deeds on subsequential events beyond the seen wheels of specific individuals. Next to this emphasis, Skinner's own interest in the intentions and aims bring back the study of individual authors to the fore, whereas context, legitimization and rhetoric relate the individual authors to their surroundings in more concrete terms. As far as seeing Dan in this sequence is concerned, I think that we can say that he rather accommodates both views in a more balanced and adaptable set, as one can tell from his provision of weighed overviews and stories. Turning this to the disciplinary level, Pocock has shown us the potencies of reconstruction that history provides in relation to political science and to various academic idioms of theory, whereas Skinner has sought instead to offer a strict history as a critical corrective to theories of politics and philosophy. Dan, on the other hand, has provided a more moderate merge between strict history, past politics and past philosophy, and has also retained a concern for contemporary political theory issues. Moving also to the socio-political level, Pocock's domestication of undersighted voices and themes in our mainstream culture through his historical reconstruction has had one effect among many others in their serving as a means for reshaping political identities in the present, as we can tell through his projects on republicanism and his area histories. Skinner also has been showing an increasingly growing advocacy of an active republicanism that reintroduces lost historical insights into contemporary discussion, whereas Dan reminds us of the need to work with a more established democracy, as well as to increase the place of individual judgment in the process. And I close with a more personal comment in seeing the Cambridge School as instructive of the importance of retaining and further striving to work on a personal stand in academics and beyond by means of intellectual commitment and ongoing dialogue. This being so, may I ask you, Professor Strunk, to, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, to present the comments on my dissertation that you see justifiable.
Thank you. Konstantinos Bizas has put forward a manuscript with the title Cambridge Classics in the History of Ideas, Main Studies and Commitments of Method in the Work of Quentin Skinner and John Donne. The so-called Cambridge School was unquestionably one of the most influential schools in 20th century history of political thought. The publications of Pocock, Quentin Skinner, John Donne and others generated a renewed interest in historical approaches to the study of politics and heated methodological debates on the relation between history, politics and philosophy. They were also part of the so-called linguistic turn in the social and human sciences, emphasizing the role of language and rhetoric in the study of political thought. And as such, the school has during the past decades often been associated with the German Begriffsgeschichte associated with Reinhard Koselleck. The significance of the Cambridge School for our disciplines can hardly be exaggerated. At the same time, there is among us scholars an unfortunate tendency of viewing the Cambridge School as some kind of perennial novelty, as these eternal revolutionaries, even though in many respects their perspectives and interpretations have become almost mainstream. It is, after all, over half a century since the authors that we associate with the Cambridge School, Pocock, Skinner, Dunn, rose to the spotlight. As the title of Beza's dissertation correctly states, the Cambridge School has become the Cambridge Classics. And as such, the time is undoubtedly ripe to put these authors themselves into focus of scholarly scrutiny. And from this perspective, Konstantinos Beza's dissertation is a most welcome intervention. The available literature on the Cambridge School is often written from within the movement itself, in autobiographical accounts or author meets critics kind of publications. Beza's dissertation is written from the outside as a systematization and anatomization of the works of Skinner and Dunn. Existing literature on the Cambridge School is also largely focused on Quentin Skinner, who is also at the center of attention in Beza's work, but especially valuable in the work that we will discuss today is the part on John Donne, a figure that perhaps is not less read than Skinner, but whose position among the Cambridge classic has been somewhat overshadowed by that of Skinner and Pocock. There is also, as Beza rightly points out in his introduction, a lot of clichés surrounding the Cambridge School. It's often treated as a monolithic whole, ignoring the originality of the individual authors. And it's often reduced, and this I have been guilty of myself, reduced into one or two methodological essays from the 60s, ignoring both the actual application of these ideas in more empirical works and the development of the ideas of the Cambridge classics from the 60s up until our time. So I have therefore read Konstantinos Beza's manuscript with great interest, and I look forward to our discussion. So we can sit down now. So my task here is to act as the conductor of an intelligent discussion of your thesis. And the structure, as you pointed out yourself in your lectio, the structure of the thesis is admirably simple. After the introduction, there is a part on Skinner and one part on Dunn, and then there are some overall conclusions. And I suggest that our discussion follows roughly the same structure. I will start by asking some general questions about your aims and choices when it comes to the thesis. And this discussion will then lead us into the introduction. And then we will spend some time on Skinner, then some time on Dunn. And finally, we will kind of try to raise the level and talk a bit more abstractly about your general conclusions and findings and the results of the thesis as a whole. I gather this sounds good.
Thank you, Sher.
So let's start with a really, really easy one and a rather more personal one. Could you provide me with some kind of background for your own interest in this topic of the Cambridge School? When did you become interested in the Cambridge classics, and what was it that intrigued you in their thinking and in their work? What was it that drew your attention to them?
Well, thank you very much for this lovely question. I think that the best way to start answering to this would be to turn slightly autobiographical in this respect. I should let you know that my academic formation is quite unusual in what counts as our nowadays constellation of different academic departmentalizations. I come from the University of Athens, which from its very beginning has been meant to produce scholars that have the self-consciousness of a national intellectual, and therefore they tend to get quite comprehensive in the way they deal with knowledge and with different research objects. This was especially the case with the humanities, and as far as my own department in Athens was concerned, I studied at the Department of Political Science, which was quite hegemonic in the different social sciences. Therefore, my background has included quite strong readings in philosophy, the social sciences, and a little bit of economics and law. Therefore, I gradually developed my expertise in one of the most prestigious fields of expertise in political science, which was that of political philosophy, which meant that I started investigating the so-called canon of political philosophy from the ancient times until the 19th and the 20th century. And as soon as I moved to continue my studies in the United Kingdom, I noticed that there was a kind of narrowing down in the way we usually approach to political philosophy. I mean, the most readily available methodology that I found on the topic when I reached the United Kingdom was that of the Cambridge School, as this was offered through their old methodological articles. However, as a result of my broader background, I felt that this was not a quite adequate way to draw benefit out of the Cambridge School approach. Therefore, I wanted to work by providing some remedy upon this background. In this respect, I came across some of the early works that started historicizing the words and deeds of the Cambridge School by various authors that I will probably leave unnamed, at least for the time being. And therefore, I found best to deepen upon this kind of approach by providing what I take to be a point of view that can combine the different merits of what have been the offered accounts in this kind of scholarship, such as those that focus on the methodological articles or the autobiographical accounts, as well as to combine what I take to be the most useful insights from the already advancing scholarship by political scientists, political theorists, political philosophers, and so on, as well as to try to keep up the way I have been educated in Greece, which has to do with keeping up the more comprehensive level of knowledge on the surface, which also includes a strong reference on how much the ongoing scholarship that gets being produced has strong ties to views and perspectives that come from the deeper past. I believe that this emphasis of sticking to the latest fashion in academics in each decade, even though it is quite beneficial in bringing up new insights that catch up with the latest phenomena and the latest interests that gain currency from time to time, is quite susceptible into losing from the horizon the important use that we have, that we owe to older voices, and the benefits that we can take from how older authors have tried to solve with problems, which even though they might not be exactly the same like the ones that we are facing, still bear some quite strong similarities. And therefore, instead of trying to devise a novel approach from time to time, we can still draw insights from the classics of its discipline. In this respect, I have tried to provide a similar outlook for the Cambridge School authors into viewing them as classics, in order to encourage both other authors who are interested in this kind of reading to start to appreciate them in a similar light, as well as to encourage a more general tendency to keep up the classics in our horizon in the ongoing constellation of changing fashions in contemporary academic humanities.
So it was some kind of annoyance with the Cambridge School's way of narrowing down the history of philosophy or the history of political thought that kind of provoked you. So you had. And then also you have one autobiographical ambition in this thesis, and then you have a methodological kind of ambition in the thesis at the same time. But both of them kind of come from this you're disturbed with something in the Cambridge school. That's what drives you. And I mean, the reason that I ask this question is I'm sometimes accused of being too American, in the sense that I always look for the point, the thesis. So I'm a bit, the reason I ask what's driving you in writing this, or what's behind and motivating you in writing this thesis, is that I'm a bit, having read this, you have done a massive job in going through an enormous amount of literature, but I'm still kind of looking for the thesis of the thesis, if you understand what I mean. What is the central point? You talk in your lectio about different things relating to gaps in their methodology and their narrowing down of the history of thought, but I'm waiting for a gap or a point, in what way does your thesis reform what we know about the Cambridge school previously? Could this have been emphasized more strongly in your thesis, do you think? And what would you have written in such a paragraph which says that this, which starts with this thesis reforms what we know about the Cambridge school in the following way? Is that a too complicated question?
I think that it is a brilliant question, but that it raises too many issues for me to reply on a single account. I would prefer to reply them in more individual terms, but I will try to satisfy your quite demanding point of view. Well, my main worry when I started reading the Cambridge School was not that much that these authors were wrong or that they were not meritorious or beneficial. We are talking about some of the most learned authors in contemporary humanities. I believe that this is a locus communis nowadays. What mostly worried me was the reception that they were facing. I mean, the way that they were taught in introductory courses sounded to me quite unappealing. Having been educated in various different kinds of disciplines in the humanities and drawing the benefits of various kinds of perspective and modes of expertise, I felt that we can learn much more out of the Cambridge School than the way that that it has been taught up to now. In this respect, I try to introduce different methods in the way I have been working by providing an overall framework about them. This being so, I think that the time has come to perhaps summarize what I take to be my distinctive methodology in my own work, which has to do principally with a close comparative reading of texts, which basically comes from my political science disciplinary background, where we usually work with a comparative method. But adding to this, I sense that we had need of some broader lights which can help us capture the broader method at work, if you wish, which had to do with keeping up a more social science point of reference through the work of Max Weber, as well as in keeping a biographical account, which I would be stricter to distinguish from the autobiography. The autobiographical perspective would be a project that Professor Skinner himself or Professor Dunn would bring about. And usually there is a slight distinction here, since the biography perspective is something that comes from a third person and therefore allows for some objectivity or at least for some distance perspective, whereas the autobiographical approach would be even more sensitive since it would come from the persons themselves. Whereas adding to this, even though I try to keep up the overall framework with a biographical approach, I try also to keep up the more individual details by sticking to the contexts, which is a lesson that I also drew from these fantastic authors. Whereas in turning to the second part of your question, which has to do with what is my point or what I try to succeed out of this scholarship. Well, I think that it has been getting increasingly difficult to draw benefits out of this entire kind of scholarship that has been produced under the label of the Cambridge School. I mean, if one sticks to the methodological articles, as you quite rightly pointed out in your introductory note, we are missing too many things in what has to do with how the authors kept on revising their views, both in their historical research as well as in the later methodological articles. Furthermore, we are missing the context of the original methodological articles themselves. I believe that we can understand better what the authors meant there by putting them both into a wider biographical background as well as by situating them in the more individual context that had a role in the very creation of them. This being so, with my own account, I try to facilitate the accessibility of the Cambridge School to outsiders and to beginners, as well as to people who have already been drawing benefit out of this work, by making it more systematic. This means that I have tried to keep up a fuller picture in firm consequence with my interest in keeping up the comprehensive outlook of knowledge, which means that I hope that through reading my work, I allow my readers both to keep up what has been more general in the very making of the school, how this has impacted the more individual ways in which Skinner and Dunn have been working in the more individual texts, whereas in order to clarify some more hard-to-understand points, I also show how the author shaped these views on a more contextual level, which also allows us to see the different kinds of interlocutors that were engaged in this process, which can also invite people that work on third disciplines to draw some greater interest in the way Skinner and Pocock and John Dunn have been working. For instance, in various parts of my contextual references, I refer to how Skinner and Dunn read the work of Max Weber, how they reasoned with poststructural trends, with Beckriff's Geschichte, with John Rawls, with Ronald Dworkin, Amartya Sen, and so on. This being so, I try to show that the way that the Cambridge School works does not negate these different kinds of expertise in the neighboring specializations in the academic humanities. And therefore, I try to invite people that work in these kinds of research areas to keep up drawing insights by reading the Cambridge School, by showing that they have a relevance for the way Pocock and Dunn and Skinner and Dunn have been working. This being so, I would say that what I try to do in the end, and more specifically in my general conclusion, has to do with systematizing the way that beginners can draw insights from the different methodological devices that the authors have brought forward in the different periods of their career, which I try to keep up in some concord and show how they can be combined. Then I expand this overview on the disciplinary and the sociopolitical level in order to draw the attention of people that work on these modes of approaching knowledge in academics, in order to make my work and the examined author's work as easy to grasp by thirds as possible. I hope that this provides an initial response, which is always open to further clarifications.
Yes, thank you. I think it was clarifying. I think actually the first thing that you said, that one of your annoyances is not so much with them, but the way that they are teached and how they are conceived of in literature is very enlightening, and I think that's a good answer in many respects. We could perhaps stick a bit with this approach method thing that you led our discussion into, and in the title you say that you talk about the Cambridge classics in the history of ideas, and then in the parts of the manuscript where you talk about discipline, you always talk about the relation between history, politics, and philosophy. So I'm thinking about like the concept of history of ideas. Is that kind of a more general way of talking about what the Cambridge School was doing within this kind of relational field between history, politics, and philosophy, or what is it? And related to this, I'm also kind of intrigued by the very first page of the thesis where you say that you want to treat the founding fathers of the Cambridge schools like the discipline's established classics. And that leads me to a question also which relates to this history of ideas, history, politics, or philosophy. Is this a Cambridge-style intellectual history about the Cambridge School? Or is it a more political science account of the Cambridge School? Does that question make sense to you?
The latter part of the question is slightly dubious because, as I tried to show in my introduction, this whole making of history in Cambridge was political scientific from the beginning. Mm. Therefore, I do not see this kind of tension between a political science and the Cambridge School on the other hand. Yes. I tend to see the Cambridge School as quite much into political science, especially in its early days, and I try to see the generations that include the classics that I examine, as well as the two previous generations, as bringing up various modes of research that have been mostly established in political science. Therefore, by providing this kind of account, I try to re-establish the lost connection between the more ordinarily conceived political science and the way that the Cambridge School approach has been working. Also, in what has to do with the question on whether my own writing of the thesis has been is Cambridge School styled or it has a more different approach, I would like to hope that I keep up this spirit of bringing things together, which means that I have tried to show in practice what I take to be the most useful insights that I eventually put in my different conclusions in the different parts of my text by showing how they can be used in practice by studying the authors themselves. But I try to show that this can be combined with further insights such as those that we find in Max Weber, in various inserts that come from philosophy, and as well as from the merits in working as a historian, as the greatest part of my dissertation probably allows readers to see. I do not know if this is quite much the question that you have been asking for. I have also noted your... Yeah. Sorry, you want to...
No, no. Go on.
I think that you raised a quite important point in your questioning of what I mean with the history of ideas at the beginning. This is a quite good and insightful question. Well, there were two reasons for choosing this term as the very title of the work. The first of them has to do with the fact that I try to keep up as historical and as close to the author's own chosen idiom as possible. This is what they mostly view themselves as doing throughout the years, even though they recently have expanded their approach into claiming that they are bringing up a more general kind of intellectual history next to their more focused expertise on the history of political thought. This could leave a question on why I stick to their history of ideas components instead of the history of political thought. The answer has to do with the fact that I believe that this allows us to reach into a more concrete level of detail. I believe that by sticking to the way that they have examined individual ideas instead of the way they have examined the political thought of individual authors allows us to see the merits of their approaches in a wider range of authors. Since in the text that I have been examining, they tend to start from the ancient times and reach until the 20th or the 21st or the 21st century. Therefore, by sticking to the history of ideas component, which we can reach into the greater level of detail that the work of these authors can give us from the point of view of method, which can be useful for also being able to grasp what is at stake with their history of political thought, their methodological articles, and with their broader ventures as well. So this is why I stick to the term history of ideas. However, as I try to show by appealing to conceptual history at the very beginning of my dissertation, I try to show that this does not need necessarily to be attached only to the Anglophone or to the very Cambridgean idiom of seeing things as how to work on such topics in academics. This is why I chose this label that originates from Germany and has strong currents in various other places, such as in Scandinavia, Latin America, the Iberian Peninsula, various parts of Asia, and so on. So I try to show that the way that these authors have been working, it can be also telling for people that work in other disciplines as well. So this is why I appeal to conceptual history as an even broader label that can invite people who are not so much acquainted with the Cambridge idiom to keep up drawing insights from this kind of approach. Whereas in what has to do with your questions of how all this deals with the more established disciplines of philosophy, history, and political science, in case you ask on such a topic, I would say that sticking to the elementary level that history of ideas of this kind and in this light allows us to reach can be most useful for drawing the attention of all these established disciplines, because all of them work with providing individual kind of research that we usually can identify as being historical, meaning that they go more individual and that they more individual in their points of reference, and that they go on concretizing their sources by being more precise in what has to do with the when and the where of the different authors. Whereas the component of the ideas also appears to all three disciplines, since philosophers deal more or less with arguments, which can be easily individualized in ideas. Political science works a lot by being definitional with concepts, whereas some of its own fields of expertise, such as political philosophy and the history of political thought, quite much examine ideas. Whereas academic history itself also has a quite strong idea-based components, both in what has to do with its intellectual history sub-discipline, as well as with a conceptual equipment with which the other varieties of academic history unavoidably work, no matter their own more individual subject matter.
Thank you. Can we stick with this for one more question? And it's a more concrete one. And it's about... It's basically the same question, but I'm asking it from the perspective of what literature are you contributing to? What is the literature that you want to contribute? Or who do you want... Who is your expected audience? I mean, there is a wide literature on Hobbes, democracy, republicanism, etc., that builds on the work of Skinner and Dunn. I don't think that this is the literature that you're kind of intending to contribute to. And then there are pieces on the program and intellectual development of Skinner, etc. There is Petri Koikkalainen, who has done a kind of Cambridge styled examination on the Cambridge School, tried to contextualize them in the political context and so forth. And then we have the Kustos here, who has written a great book on Skinner, which both kind of contextualizes and theorizes a Skinner and goes beyond him in many respects. And I'm kind of with what literature, what kind of direction of literature is it that you want to contribute, and who is it? I mean, you probably answered this already by claiming to this by referring already in the introduction of your lectio to and also in the first sentence of your dissertation to the conceptual historians. This family of conceptual historians, are those your intended audience, or what is your who? When I write my things, I always have an audience in my, like, often it's just a seminar of five people or something like that, but an intended audience. Who do you want to read it?
Well, thank you very much for this question. It is a quite synthetic question, and therefore it is not quite easy to respond, but I will do my best, as always, not to let you down. I think that you are quite right in indicating that I do not appeal quite much to individual experts on Hobbes or other topics, aside perhaps from the people who study the concept of the state or the concept of democracy. I hope that by analyzing those grand names in those two very special topics, perhaps people that will read my dissertation will be greatly assisted from this point of view. But as you rightly suggest, I have a more general audience in mind, as I have been trying to bring up by answering these different questions and by writing this book. I try to keep up the need to keep things as plain as possible. Therefore, I try to appeal to some of the more general audience in academics, and especially to beginners. This means that I am mostly interesting to help beginners and outsiders to draw interest in the way the Cambridge School has been working. This being so, I would like also to hope that some of the more experts on the Cambridge School up to now can be facilitated in the overall appreciation of the school, and especially of its three classics, which can also provide a key for being able to follow the next generations of Cambridge scholarship, meaning the students of those people and other people who have been working by throwing insights of their approach. I mean that various people that work in conceptual history or various other historians of ideas and intellectual historians that have been throwing on the Cambridge School can be more easily appreciated and followed by theirs as soon as we clarify what the classics were meaning. Therefore, I believe that my work can be useful not only for beginners and outsiders, but also for other kinds of experts in the history of ideas, the history of concepts, intellectual history, and historians of political thought of various kinds, by clarifying what these loci communi in the profession have been meaning by their different works. Also, I would like to believe that this kind of approach can facilitate comparisons between this intellectual movement with other approaches, such as the Begriffsgeschichte approach that you have already brought up, Professor Roshan Ballon's more French-styled approach on the conceptual history of the political, and various other approaches, such as the United States approaches and so on. I believe that if we systematize the Cambridge School in these terms, we can encourage authors who study these kinds of traditions to systematize them in some similar lights, and therefore make it even more easier for people to draw some combinatory benefits out of the different approaches. But I believe that what you have been asking more or less is what is the more narrow kind of scholarship to which I am contributing by writing this book.
And who will you send a copy of your dissertation to? That's another way of asking the same question.
I feel too much of a beginner in academics to send my book to anyone. I will be very honored for any kind of reader that will be interested in my book. Well, you give me the chance to say here that I certainly stand on the shoulders of giants in various respects. Well, as I started saying in some earlier questions, my main worry has to do with the great scholarship that has been commenting on the Cambridge School by focusing mostly on the methodological articles. I believe that this is not a bad kind of scholarship, but that it tends to over-formalize things, and that it leaves too many things outside of the picture. Therefore, this is the one kind of audience to which I am appealing, and whom I believe that they will probably have an interest to read and perhaps comment on my book. This is the one pole of the usual way in which the Cambridge School has been received today. On the other hand, there has been a quite different pole, which has appeared mostly in later years. This has to do with the need to try to learn from the work of these authors as historians by practice, which leaves all the methodological stuff outside, and which has been working on more historical or perhaps some slightly biographical terms, but they have mostly stick to some more individualized issues, such as one can tell from the special volume on the writing of the foundations of modern political thought in 2003. Whereas I think that I start more closely to some works that have been produced on from disciplinary political scientists, such as the known work on Quentin Skinner by a historically and empirically oriented political scientist, which is closer to my own approach, which I try to expand for the Cambridge School as a whole, as well as to integrate with my own disciplinary background. Whereas next to this scholarship, you have also brought up the work of dear Professor Petri Koikalainen, to which I should also add the work of Professor Alexander, who also are quite much disciplinary speaking political scientists, even though they identify themselves as political theorists or political philosophers, most probably. And I would say that that the way that they have worked in their own Cambridge School accounts has been quite close to my own research interests, even though I believe that their most individual archetype in what has to do with their own method comes from what is usually identified as political sociology, meaning that they try to gather the individual information and fit them into some broad categories that can be said to explain the more individual kind of information. Even though I find this kind of approach instructive, I try to keep up some missing bits that this kind of approach has been tending to leave outside, which has to do with a stricter contextualization of more individual elements that we find in the work of the examined authors, as well as in the original making of the school, as well as with the provision of some more comprehensive framework in less qualified terms than these more theoretical and philosophy-oriented approaches have been tending to do. In this respect, I hope to keep up some kind of golden balance between the different approaches, but of course this is what each scholar wishes for, and this is an issue that only the readership can touch, whether it has been done in a satisfactory way or not.
Final question on your own kind of approach is this concept of a special logic that you attribute to Max Weber. Could you just explain a bit more what you mean with that? It seems to be something about arranging sources in a kind of a narrative or a kind of system of some sort. So, but could you perhaps say a bit more about that and why it's important for an important perspective for your thesis? And is there anyone else who has utilized this kind of special logic as a kind of a methodological device in their work in a similar kind of way? Do you have a previous model on doing this?
Max Weber himself.
Of course, but beyond that.
let's say that as a person who is present here can tell, not everyone is quite satisfied with the Weberian scholarship nowadays. Usually this is thick either to devoted monographical experts who are quite insightful into contextualizing things, but I believe that they are missing some aspects of the usefulness of Max Weber's work for thirds. I try to bring this up with this concept of special logic. Well, as far as I understand your question, what you ask is first a clarification of what special logic means, at least in my work and in Weber's work.
Or in your work, why is it important in your work? That's kind of the...
Well, I was impressed from the way that Max Weber used it in his methodological article. What Max Weber tried to do there was to appeal to an older term that first appeared, to my knowledge, in early 18th century German academics. The term special logic back then, as it was used, was meant to provide some kind of mediation between the more formal logic of philosophical discussions in the universitarian departments of the time, with some more moderate and first-hand research that we nowadays identify as being more historical in character. Therefore, I believe that Weber brings up this kind of background when he makes his own intervention and try to combine the different scientific idioms of his time by saying that he will study the special logic of what he calls the cultural sciences of the or the social sciences, as he calls them in some later articles. And I try to show that we can stick into providing some similar kind of mediation. So by saying that I quite much focus on the spatial logic, I try to show that what I mean by that by keeping up an interest for the overall logic of the accounts that we read is that we should not be necessarily lost inside detail. However, in order to avoid some excessive formalization, I try to keep up to this idiom of a spatial logic, which means that we should strive to keep up the overall picture by sticking as much as possible to the terms that we find to the text themselves. This means that I call for more or less of a balancing between the individual elements that we find in the actual sources with which we are working, as well as with the interest to see a more overall coherence in the offered account. This is an outlook that I have been trying to keep up in my own research as I present it here, and this is why I begin with providing some more overall context with the original making of the school, whereas when I move to the individual authors, I try to begin by bringing up some more comprehensive background by what I call in the introductory sub-chapters in my two main chapters as the main context and method that I use for the more individual reasons of studying the work of these two authors. Then I move to the more particular elements by sticking as much to being historical as possible, whereas in the end I try to rearrange this entirety of perspectives into some more general lights that can hope to combine both the historicity that I have gained by working on these more individual levels and by sticking to the biographical approach, as well as with my strive to keep up a level of relevance and easy to access tellingness for academics and the broader readership in the most telling ways that I found available.
So it is a way of, the spatial logic is a device to combine and put together the kind of biographical and theoretical in a kind of a whole. I think that makes good sense. That's a good answer. I've spent quite some time dealing with your approach and method and these kinds of issues. I found your historical account in the first in the introductory chapter really great. I don't have any questions to that. But there is one question that needs to be asked, and you probably know what that question is, and that's basically why Skinner and Dunn, and of course the reason that I ask is Pocock, who figures in both the introduction and in the end, and of course the Cambridge School can be defined as wider than those three as well, but those three are the main figures in your definition and in most definitions, I think, but. And everyone is, of course, free to choose who they want to focus on, but there has to be some kind of motivation. And in your case, also, the absence of Pocock is kind of staring the reader in the face. Like, if you know Sartre, the analogy of Pierre in the café, that the nothingness of Pocock is really kind of staring you in the face. So the explanations you offer for this omission in the dissertation are quite short, like unfortunately omitted, and you also refer to an initially overambitious doctoral dissertation and so forth. But for me, these kind of phrases, they kind of accentuate like the nothingness or the absence of Pocock. So I'll give you now a chance to provide a more scholarly justification for focusing on Skinner and Dunn and not Pocock.
Well, thank you very much for this question. As you might be guessing, and as you quite rightly pointed out, my original ambition was to cover all three authors, Pocock, Skinner and Dunn. I take these three for the reasons that I outlined in my introductory chapter to have been the three main figures that have been pulling the ropes in the making and in the various modes of reworking of the Cambridge School. And these are the three authors that most people that study according to the Cambridge School idiom are more accustomed to study. Therefore, these are the three more natural starting points for appreciating the Cambridge School. However, I had already corrected enough material out of getting analytical in only two out of three authors. Therefore, I had to choose only two names. In this respect, the choice was a slightly difficult one. In the first place, I should definitely refer to Quentin Skinner, since he has been the leading voice in practically the entirety of the Cambridge School initiatives. He is quite much of a strong personality, and he's actually the person that has generated the most students of the following generations of the Cambridge School. Even James Tully, who originally started working with Professor Dunn, gradually moved to work with Professor Skinner as the years went by. Therefore, Professor Skinner could not be absent from this kind of introductory account. Following this, I had to choose between Pocock and Dunn. In this respect, I believe that Pocock has already received quite much the attention that he has been deserving throughout the years. This has to do with the fact that since the introductory courses on the Cambridge School usually focus on the methodological articles, and Pocock has written quite many of them, perhaps they are 10, 15, perhaps even 20, I have lost counting there. I think that Pocock has already drawn quite a lot of attention. And therefore, I believe that what was more urgent for a fuller appreciation of the Cambridge School was to stick to Professor Dunn's work, which, to my knowledge, perhaps my own text is one of the first inquiries that reach into such analytical level of detail, to my humble knowledge. Therefore, I believe that by bringing Dunn back to the picture, we can have a fuller understanding of the Cambridge School. Furthermore, I should let you know that actually Dunn has remained in Cambridge throughout the years, and therefore he has been quite active into bringing forward various initiatives of the school, as well as into influencing the way that Skinner modifies his views from time to time as we move from the one decade to the next one. Whereas Pocock, on the other hand, has worked on a distance from the actual institution of Cambridge from quite early on, and especially from the 1960s onwards. And in this respect, what seems to be more Cambridgian in Pocock has to do with his providing comments to Skinner's and to a lesser extent to Dunn's initiatives from a rather external point of view that tries to provide an alternative picture of things, as well as to apply and modify the approaches that Skinner and Dunn have been bringing forward for his own interests in terms of a geographical scope. Therefore, I believe that even though Pocock is also highly insightful, I think that for the time being, we have more urgent reasons to clarify what has been at stake with Skinner and Dunn. However, since I am an early career scholar, I should confess at this point that I aim to expand this study into a postdoctoral project in which I would like to cover this missing chapter on Pocock, and therefore I will be able to provide a more comprehensive overview of the Cambridge School, which can be also telling enough for people who have found greater benefits to work with Professor Pocock's approach, or that who work in the areas or in the geographical scope that Pocock usually works. Probably this kind of people will be more interested to draw more insights out of Pocock's work, and therefore they will be looking forward to read more analytically about Pocock himself. I hope that this covers your question.
Yes, I mean, I am not arguing that you should have included Pocock. It's just a bit disturbing, the way that he's introduced now and then in the book, but I think your motivations are perfectly valid. Skinner is the main figure, and Dunn is often ignored and so forth. I think it works well. We must move on to the empirical chapter. I've spent quite some time on the introduction, but I think that's fair and also really fulfills like the idea of a defense. And I think that the idea of the main idea of an approach of the thesis is important to deal with in such a defense. But let's go to Skinner and. Both these empirical chapters, or this consists of an introductory part where you contextualize the authors, give some basic background as to the books that you analyze and career moves and so forth, and you also provide some further depth into this methodological approach of the looking for the special logic and so forth. But then the chapters on Skinner and Dunn, they go in two different directions. They are kind of systematized in two different ways. So the chapter on Skinner deals with four periodical sub-chapters where you discuss Skinner's treatment of the state first in Roman times up until the 16th century, and then the 16th and 17th century, then the long 19th century or something like that, and then a final chapter of the 19th and 20th century. In Dunn's case, you move forward chronologically from the perspective of his authorship. So you start with his own work on Locke, and then you move forward to his different books on democracy in the 90s and 2000s. So the obvious question is, why did you choose to treat these differently in this way?
So thank you very much for your question. I believe that before I move on answering what is different in these two main chapters of my work, I should probably say something about the way that I want people to conceive of the general way that I have been working in these two main chapters. You have brought up the presence of context in the introductory subdivisions of each chapter. This is very true, but these are once again the more general context that help us understand Skinner's and Dunn's more particular intellectual formations. This is why I mostly there stick to their institutional allegiances or the way that they have sought to hold offices that show us what were their more individual orientation of their research interests. However, aside from this rather general context, I have tried to go into greater detail in my contextualization, and this is why I provide quite many contexts also in the rest of the subdivisions of the two chapters. However, I try to keep this mostly in my footnotes, since I do not want the readers who are interested mostly in the general picture to miss the sequence of my overall account. This means that people that want to learn more particular information about how Skinner has worked or how Dunn has worked can also read the footnotes and therefore see how Skinner deals with more individual interlocutors as the years go by and Dunn as well. Therefore, I would see the presence of context both in my introductory subdivisions as well as in the next ones. However, I think that you are right that what is more interesting has to do with the reason why I stick to some different kind of treatments in the way I read the work of the two authors. I believe that this has to do with the fact that there were different ways into facilitating the comparative close reading that I tried to do in their different texts. This has to do with the fact that as my retrospective conclusions in the different chapters show more fully, the way that Skinner has worked in his different individual texts does not always mind for the overall effects of his accounts. This means that Skinner usually provides more individualized interventions. This means that he tends to provide pieces on some more individualized periods or on pieces that discuss only some of the topics of each, some of the authors of each period and so on. This means that it is quite easy for people that read Skinner's more individual texts to miss what is the context or what other kind of authors were available in the different periods that Skinner has been examining. This means that if one sticks to the way Skinner has been working in the different sources, it's quite easy to lose this. Therefore, I believe that what is best for appreciating the way Skinner has been dealing with the different sources in the different period, has been an individualization of the different periods that Skinner has been using himself throughout the works. Therefore, another reason for adopting this strategy in Skinner's work has to do with the fact that not all of his texts deal with all the periods. I mean, his earliest text from 1989 deals with the earlier periods that he's examining, and this text has been revised in 2002. However, in between, Skinner started working on the following periods by not being quite much analytical on where would this leave his work on the previous periods, since this has also included some slight and tacit modifications in what he was claiming for the previous authors. Therefore, I believe that the best way to appreciate what Skinner is doing there in Fuller Lights has to do by individualizing the different chronological periods in these terms. On the other hand, with Professor Dunn's approach, we do not have to deal with such a demanding level of detail, at least in this light, since Dunn has been interesting to provide overall accounts quite much from the beginning as he was studying the history of democracy. I mean, all his main writings on the history of democracy quite much examine the entire trajectory of democracy from ancient Greece up to present, even though he has different chronological and geographical emphasis in the different texts, which is natural, but there is always a quite visible treatment of the different individual periods. And therefore, it has been more easy to identify what changes as we move from the one text to the other, in case we stick to a simpler biographical approach. Furthermore, as I tried to show in my lectio, the way Dunn has been working on democracy and on various other features in what I take to be his method at work has quite many substantial dues on his received method from John Locke. And therefore, I wanted to show that the way that he has been working on Locke in his early days has been pivotal and instructive in many respects in his adoption of an ethos on how he has been working in the following years and in how he has been treating the elaboration of an overall picture for the history of democracy as we move from the one chronological period to the next one. Therefore, I believe that a simpler biographical approach in Professor Dunn's work for the entirety of the subdivisions can resolve what has been at stake as we move from the one text to the next one, whereas in Professor Skinner's case, I had to go to an even more demanding level of detail by individualizing how he deals with the authors and the arguments of the different chronological periods. I hope that this provides some answers.
This provides some answers, but I will stick to this, and this will probably be the most the place where we kind of confront each other most strongly today in our defense, in your defense. But I was thinking about what kind of picture these choices make of Skinner and Dunn. And you're clearly more sympathetic to Dunn and less so with Skinner, against whom you point some criticisms, which some of which I think is very apt and to the point, and some which I have a bit more problem with understanding or agreeing with. We can be of different opinions as well, but I mean, on page 81, you summarize your critique of Skinner by claiming that Skinner has done a great job in many ways, blah blah blah. But also claiming that he has not been very careful in attending to the special logic of his schemes. There are selective emphasis, there are gaps, and there are questionable and perplexing divisions and several changes of mind. And you also claim that he could have been assisted with a more kind of by an elaboration of more sustainable schemes to a more kind of social scientific approach or kind of cross-referencing his own work. So my question is, how should I? Yeah, the best way of asking this question: what do you think Skinner himself, who celebrates his 80th birthday today, what do you think Skinner would respond to your criticism? What would he say? Or what would he say? What would a Skinnerian say against this criticism? Do you catch my point? Do you see where I'm heading at already, or do you want me to elaborate more?
Well, I can try to provide an initial answer to this harsh criticism for which you are quite right to point me out as guilty. I think that you are quite right in your pointed remarks. I should let you know that actually my chapter on Professor Skinner's work was the earliest one that I worked when I started devising my approach. And this reflected a level in my knowledge in which I was still on a more critical phase. I was still trying to introduce insights that I received from my previous education. And so what has been missing mostly in the reception in which Skinner's work has been implicated. As soon as I started reading Skinner more analytically as the years went by, and I started getting more analytical on the fuller contextualization and the fuller reading of his other works beyond the histories of the concept of the state, came in my attention. I started modifying my appreciation of the way Professor Skinner has been working. However, one of my initial points that I would like to keep up has to do with the fact that the way that Skinner has been working with providing more individual interventions that do not deal the overall coherence of the different things that he says in his various authors that he discusses on the different periods that he examines, make him quite much susceptible of missing important gaps, of missing important authors in the different periods that he examines. Therefore, I had to reach into a greater level of detail into showing that what Skinner does is not necessarily wrong or non-instructive. However, I believe that it is susceptible into missing various things from the picture, as well as into perplexing Professor Skinner himself, as well as readers that try to draw benefit out of his work. Therefore, I was interested to draw some critical insights from this point of view. However, I should let you know that this does not mean that people should necessarily work in the way that Professor Dunn has sought to work. I should let you know that Professor Dunn stayed rather on a more low-key profile, which means that he did not draw that much attention to the Cambridge School as Professor Skinner has. This means that Skinner has been pivotal in drawing the attention of third people to the school. This means that he brought many scholars to draw insights from the profession, in which the slower way that Professor Dunn has been elaborating his own historical approach would not be quite possible to draw. This can be seen from the fact that Professor Dunn has been an expert on less historical topics than Professor Skinner has tried to do. This means that he has been an expert on Locke, on democracy, and very few other topics outside this. And therefore, I believe that we can keep up this plurality in our own offered account of what kind of insights we can draw from the Cambridge School. People who are interested for more on more shorthand and more pointy interventions can stick to the way that Professor Skinner has been working, which is the usual way that Skinnerians read Skinner himself. Whereas other people who are more interested in the more slow and overall reconsideration of structuring things in a more balanced point of view might stick to the way that Professor Dunn has been working. However, this certainly does not mean that Professor Skinner's work is unmeritorious or less valuable from any point of view. And I believe that this is the best gift that he can receive from his 80th birthday, at least from an early career reader.
very good. But let me push my point once more and be as nasty as I will be today. It will all be easy from here on. But when you talk about Skinner's selective emphasis and his several chains of mind and his lack of coherence, it seems to me as a very un-Skinnerian turn of words or un-Skinnerian way of thinking about things. And I have two ways of making this point. I mean, the first is simply to claim that you are allowed to change your mind and that the paradoxes and conflicts that you point at follow from the fact that he has written stuff in different periods in his life, and it's very difficult to create a coherent intellectual profile of works that span over kind of 50 years, and moreover, when you choose to treat him in the way that you do, which is different from the way that you treat Donne. Donne is allowed to grow and change his mind because you paint a chronological picture, while Skinner's kind of changes of mind become contradictions. The second way of making the same point is probably even more serious. Are you falling for the myth of coherence here? Are you trying to build a coherent intellectual system of a number of books by which Skinner wanted to do different things? In one book, he wanted to look for the origins of the state. In another one, he wanted to reconstruct republicanism. In a third, he wanted to do something else. So of course, he portrays his sources differently. For me, and I'm a Skinnerian in a very particular sense, but for me, Skinner is all about perspectives and arguments, not about construing coherent theories, and absolutely not construing coherent theories across a lifetime. So this is as nasty as I can get. It all gets easy from here, but do you have a response to this form of this Skinnerian criticism of your treatment of Skinner?
Well, I can try to provide some answer. In the first place, I would not say that what I do is necessarily un-Skinnerian, at least in this chapter, which reflects my early years and my more critical phase in academics, let's say. Perhaps one can call it as extra Skinnerian, at least in what Skinner has been doing in some periods in his life and in some of his writings. However, I should let you know that in some of the most telling writings from my point of view, such as The Foundations of Modern Political Thought or Meaning and Understanding in the History of Ideas, and some of other Skinner's early historical articles and methodological articles, Skinner has been, in my humble view, quite much close to the more orthodox Weberian social science of the times. I mean that he has been trying to weigh the different sizes that he takes into account when devising his articles. However, I think that as the years go by and as he had to face some quite strong criticism from the outside, he started getting a little more pointing in his emphasis, and this has led him to some more ambitious ventures in which from time to time he has been emphasizing some authors and some ideas that I believe do some injustice to the rest of the authors and items of its examined period. This has led Skinner from time to time to face problems as soon as he adopted this kind of strategy in what he can do, as long as he is forced to address to new arguments that he has left outside or to new authors that he has not brought up in his previous articles. In the way he has been working by providing more individual interventions that overtly emphasize this and that author, he has problem to rework on his overall theory when he's brought up with authors and arguments that he has left on the outside. On the other hand, since Professor Donne has been has been mindful of what can possibly be the future consequences of the growing scholarship on the different topics that she has been examining. I believe that this mode of thinking has allowed Dan to keep up a more easily adaptable account as the years go by. This means that when Dan modifies his accounts, this is not so much a contradiction of what he was saying in the previous years. This is quite much of an elaboration of his earlier views through an enrichment of more sources. However, what Skinner says from the one text to the other, especially on the concept of the state, seems to be quite literally speaking contradictory. He claims different things on the conclusions of the foundations, different things in Liberty Before Liberalism, different things in other texts, and so on. So it is not that much a matter of changing one's mind. This is legitimate, all people do, including ourselves, Professor Skinner and Professor Dan as well. However, I believe that the way that Professor Dan has worked mostly on the low key and by paying attention of how future scholarship can reverse his current views has allowed him to be smoother on the way that he revises his views from time to time. My worry is that the emphasis that Skinner has shown in his different texts make him susceptible of overemphasizing some authors such as Hobbes and other devices such as those of genealogy and so on. I mean, he claims that he has been doing genealogies from the beginning. Mm. However, one does not see the term genealogy appearing in any of Skinner's works, perhaps even starting from the early 2000s and so on. And in what has to do with the state, this first appears in 2009, if I remember well. So when Skinner claims that what I have been doing was genealogical from the beginning, this does not sound to me quite much on a par with the more orthodox Weberian social science that one sees in the foundations, as well as in other articles that Skinner has elaborated from time to time. Therefore, when he has to claim that what he has been doing has been both a genealogical work as well as a more orthodox social science-oriented historical research, this might create aporia to authors that are more demanding in what has to do with the overall picture of his works. Therefore, perhaps the term coherence is not quite much the most appropriate term here, and I have tried to avoid it in my own account. So I try to show, at least in Dan's chapter, which I worked more recently and in more informed lights, I try to say that these authors mind for the overall coherence that their outlook allows. I don't mean that they necessarily fill up this coherence. I try to show that the way that these authors work allow for the coherence to be further inferred in the light of further information that can be brought forward. For instance, one can see this in Professor Dan's work, who knows very well that not all the areas of the globe have produced scholarship on the history of democracy on the same level as the one that we have on the West. Therefore, when he addresses non-Western environments, he is more moderate. And when he addresses even the Western environments, he tries to show that this is only one perspective in how one can view democracy, and he tries to keep up a more low-key tone. On the other hand, the way Skinner works by emphasizing Hobbes or other authors, for instance, would make it difficult for authors that have different kinds of interests. Such as the French scholars, who would be more interested to emphasize Bodin in the making of the state. This overemphasis on Hobbes would leave them probably with some question marks there. For instance, since Hobbes was admiring Bodin, if one emphasizes Hobbes as the pivotal author in the modification of the concept of the state, how would this leave Bodin scholars feel? Although Hobbes himself has quite much expressed his admiration on Hobbes of Bodin, and we see Hobbes drawing quite much on Bodin's argumentation. Therefore, if future scholarship shows that Bodin has been using the state in similar ways with those of Hobbes, where would this leave Skinner scholarship? This is my worry. Thank you very much.
Very well. Yeah, I agree. I think that it becomes very, very much clear from the dissertation that you sympathize with Dunn's more moderate account, and you also rightly, I think, praise his kind of transnational interest and so forth. But there is also like a, you can be imperialist in two ways when you're sitting at the center of the world in the great universities in England. You can either be imperialist in claiming that everyone should read Hobbes as Skinner, or then you write everyone's history for them as Donne, to put it crudely. Let's move on. You have these two. We talked very much about contradictions in Skinner, but the other thing that you talk about much about are gaps, and I think that here you talk about ancient Greece, you talk about Mill, you talk about Keynes. So my simple question is: to what extent, or how? This is a too difficult and too broad question, probably. But how would Skinner's point of view have been improved by including these? What would have what in particular? You can choose any of these. You don't have to kind of cover all these gaps because we don't have time, but. But you rightly point to the fact that Skinner does not treat certain periods. He doesn't treat ancient Greece. He doesn't treat Keynes. He doesn't give that much attention to Mill. But my question is, how would it change his view? How would it improve his point of view? And that's my last question on Skinner, and then we have one or two are done, and then a couple of conclusions, and then we're done.
Thank you very much for this fine question. I will try to respond to this as well. Well, it is not so easy from my point of view to respond to this question because I am not quite much sympathetic with this reading of Skinnerianism that makes more or less only individual interventions. What you have been asking, more or less, in case I can decipher this correctly, has to do with what would Skinner's approach, especially in his work on the state, win by introducing the sensed gaps that I have brought up here. And in this respect, I can let you know that that as far as ancient Greece is concerned, I believe that this can help us see the problems with Skinner's overemphasizing of the individualized and royalist senses of the state in his early period from the Roman times to the 16th century. As I try to show with the clues, in fact, it is the collectivist senses that are earlier than those that Skinner brings up in practically all his references to the individualist and to the royalist sense. And I try to show that Skinner could have been clearer in understanding this or being forced to bring this up in his own perception by bringing up the ancient Greek terms that stand for state, which have to do with stasis, kratos, politia and politeuma, which tend to be more collective in their origins and only gradually receive more individualist connotations. Also, this is most particularly the case with stasis, which I try to show how in its collectivist sense it moves from the ancient Greek setting to Cicero and to the other ancient Greek, ancient Roman rhetorists and jurists that Skinner takes up as his earliest references to status, which can allow him to correct his entire narrative that he builds as the chapters go by. A similar function can be seen by the other authors that I bring up, such as the Levellers, who can correct Skinner's emphasis on the state, even if one sticks to the very period that Hobbes was writing Leviathan and his other sources. I try to show by getting quite chronological year by year in those texts that the Levellers were elaborating a collectivist concept of the state that was quite similar with that of Hobbes in the same years, and therefore, by emphasizing Hobbes and the other absolutists or quasi-absolutists as being the pioneers against which the more populist authors were responding, are losing from the pictures that that the levelers and other populist authors were already talking in the about the state in such collective terms that were getting as abstract as Skinner tries to project for Hobbes and for other authors like Bourdain back in those years. A similar kind of corrective can be brought forward for later centuries as well, in which Skinner has been more interested to discuss the authors that he's more focused to criticize, such as classical utilitarianism or various academic trends in political philosophy in the 20th century. I believe that what one is missing here is that Skinner tends to get unfair with some of the most erudite authors that have been usually grouped in such terms, such as John Stuart Mill, who has had a much broader erudition than the average classical utilitarian, such as Bentham, Austin, Sidgwick, and so on. And I try to show with my passages that what he does with Mill is unfair for Mill himself, and therefore probably his scheme for the 19th century on the classical utilitarian disappearance of the state does not seem very sound if one sticks to the fuller evidence that we have in the canon of the history of political thought and other acknowledged authors. And I try to show this for the 20th century also by bringing up Keynes as the most important author, let's say, in the discipline of political economy, which has to do with the fact that the way Skinner has been treating the political philosophers or various economy-oriented political philosophers in contemporary academics tends to leave behind that not all of these people neglect the state, but Keynes, and mostly actually Keynesianism, I would say, bring back the state very emphatically. And therefore, if one takes Skinner's schemes very seriously, one misses these things from the picture. Therefore, these more middling and moderate figures, such as the Levelers, Mill, Keynes, and so on, can provide some corrective for Skinner's schemes. On the other hand, the way Dan has retained a more moderate outlook that does not leave out such more mainstream authors from the picture has been working, has allowed him to come up with some more balanced accounts that do not present this contradictory emphasis and this hard to defend schemes that Skinner has been building up from time to time.
Okay, let's leave Skinner. I enjoy your criticism in many respects. I particularly enjoyed the observation that even though Skinner often uses history as an argument of criticizing philosophy, he's quite uninterested in the historical development in the historical discipline itself. I think that's a quite good observation. If we use this as a bridge to Donne, the title of the chapter on Donne is his work on democracy and its history. And then Skinner is the more historical one of these two, in the sense that Skinner uses history as an argument against politics and philosophy, yet you emphasize history in the title for Donne. Why did you include history in the title for Donne?
Well, thank you for this question. Probably it is due to a misunderstanding from my part, for which I am the only one to blame. I take it for granted that all these people in the Cambridge School work as historians. Therefore, I certainly imply that my title in my Skinner chapter would be most fully Quentin Skinner works on the history of the concept or idea of the state, as he calls it in his different texts. And this is another contradiction that can create problems in Skinner's approach. What I try to emphasize with my Donne title is not so much the term history, as that he has been dealing with democracy aside from its history. Therefore, what I try to emphasize in my title, in my Donne chapter, has to do with the fact that Donne was not simply a historian of democracy. He has also produced many, many, many small and medium-sized tracts that try to deal with democracy from a political theory point of view that do not get so much historical on individual reference and individual geographical scopes, meaning that he has produced many pieces on legitimacy, accountability, and other more individual features of democracy as the years go by. However, in case I wanted to write a dissertation about them, I would have to get quite a lot more analytical than I have already done. And also, it would not be so interesting to individualize more individual contexts or emphasize how he deals with more individual authors and points of reference there. Therefore, I had to leave them outside. This being so, my title in this chapter on democracy and its history means that I principally focus on Dan's historical accounts of democracy. However, I try to show that these are not the only accounts that Dan has produced on democracy. This is a feature that I try to bring up in fuller detail in my conclusive subdivision in Dan's chapter, where I provide the connection of this kind of work with Dan's fuller oeuvre, as I also did with my Skinner chapter as well. And this is a place that I show how Dan is interested in political theory and how this is crowded in his more first-hand research that he has produced throughout the years. And I also try to provide some comments of how he has been theorizing democracy as well. However, this could be too large to keep it in more analytical focus in this chapter, and therefore I try to show this in the title of the chapter. I hope that this clarifies that I do not take Dan as being the only historian here. Quite much the opposite. I take Dan to be something more than a committed historian. Dan has produced quite many of essays in which he is more clearly a political theorist. And actually this is the title of his own chair. He has been a professor of political theory and an emeritus professor of political theory up to present. This has meant that Dan has been interested to reserve a part of his academic labors not only for producing historical scholarship, which is something that Skinner has been doing on a more committed basis, but that he has been interesting throughout this tendency to show off that someone is quite careful with individual sources and with getting more concrete by working as a historian, that we still have good reasons to keep up working as political theorists. This is something that can be quite easily lost in this tendency to work as historians. And this is one of the grave problems in the reading of the Cambridge School. Many people that read them simply do historical monographs on this and that topic. However, I want to show by emphasizing that Dan has been also a political theorist that this is not necessarily so. In fact, there is a quite strong political theoretical aspect also in Skinner and Pocock, but with Dan this gets the more individual focus that it deserves, and I believe that this is a feature that one can certainly emphasize by sticking to the more careful appreciation that I try to bring up for Dan's own work.
Yes, so that's roughly as I imagine that you introduce history in the title in order to emphasize that he's not only historical. One of the things that I find perhaps most fascinating, I think I like the Dunn chapter probably better, and I have less criticism and less questions on that one. But I particularly find it fascinating how you describe exactly the development of his thinking from the 70s onwards, partly the persistence of the Lockean kind of influence. I think you show that quite well. But also, I get a sense, but you're not perhaps saying it really explicitly, but I get a sense that Dunn becomes increasingly concerned with democracy, the state of democracy in his thinking. Could you, and you talk about this dualism in his thinking from early on between what is it that you call it, order of egoism and order of equality, and that this kind of this dualism is formulated more sharply towards the end or something like that. I want to ask, how would you kind of describe his increasing concern for the state of democracy? And what do you think it has to do with? Is it kind of him as a political actor in the world observing things, or is it also something about theory? Is there some kind of theoretical background to his concern?
Well, thank you very much for this question as well. This is a quite complex question, I would say. I think that once again it has various components which I should try to respond. If I understand your question well, you have been your attention has been thrown by the dualism that, among other things, that Professor Dan has been suggesting in his different texts on the history of democracy, and you have asked on how this persists throughout the different texts. I should let you know
how it persists and how it relates to his concern for democracy. Is that a too complex question? You can answer this in bits if you want.
Yes.
Or,
yeah. Yes, thank you very much. I believe that the way that Professor Dan has started emphasizing this dualism, in the first place, I should let you know that as Professor Dan says at some point in his account, it was due to István Hont. This is a perspective that István Hont brought with him from Eastern Europe as he migrated eventually to Cambridge and started working with Dan. What this has meant to clarify in Dan's early works has to do with the fact that that there was an excessive emphasis on the one understanding of democracy, which was the more left-wing, let's say, which against which Professor Dan wanted also to bring up some missing bits in the history of democracy that had been underemphasized back then. This is why he has been trying to bring up this dualism in democracy. But I should let you know that recently he has abandoned this. This is a perspective that Dan has more or less followed up until he's setting the people free in 2005. In his latest research, which addresses more or less democracy in Asia as well as a democracy in America, we do not see this dualism playing any grave role anymore, as one can tell especially from his chapter on democracy in India. Nowadays, Dan has gone more plural. He has shown that that it is one thing what we can learn from what he was calling the dualism of democracy, which likely he has kept in a low key, and therefore he has allowed it to be enriched by further conceptions of democracy. I should also let you know that I have tried to draw attention on the way Dan has elaborated this dualism of democracy in his early writings. I should let you know that I tried to capture the difference in the shadings in the way Dan has been describing this dualism. It was very austerely introduced back in 1979, since it reflected the more narrowly historical political science of the times. As the years went by, in 1992, he introduced a more reconciling connotation by referring to it as an encounter between two different instructive conceptions of democracy, which reflected the post-Soviet Union bloc climate of euphoria. Whereas by the time that we reached 2005, and Dan and the rest of the Cambridge School start dealing with some more continentally broad perspective, Dan brings up a more tense outlook for this dualism. He refers to it as an endless tug of war between two different conceptions of democracy. And therefore I try to show in what has to do with more contextual reasons why Dan insists on this dualism and how this changes. I would agree with you that it is quite right to say that Dan has been mostly focusing on the history of democracy from a certain period of his life onwards. This has certainly been the period from the 1990s up to present. This is where we find a massive proliferation of Dan's writing of democracy. In the first place, there is a contextual reason that this is so. This has to do probably with the collapse of the Soviet Union bloc and the role that democracy played there. in uniting the people against the broad ideology of the times, and bringing them together with some more Western European and American-based perspective. Dan wanted to show what are the common grounds and what are the remaining tensions in this approach, and how this can be further reworked in the future in the more individual terms that each regional case deserves. This is more or less a contextual reason, but I would say that there are also some more biographical and theoretical reasons as well. This had to do with the fact that Dan has been minding for the overall tellingness of his accounts, and as he says in some interviews, the reason that he got initially interested in Locke had to do with the fact that he believed that Locke had been pivotal both for the British 18th century political thought as well as for the American and the French Revolution. Therefore, Locke allowed him to show how all these different intellectual matrices for our present-day predicament had a common base, had a common ground. As soon as he started doing research on Locke, he started noticing that this was certainly not the case. There were much many different influences in these three broad intellectual settings other than Locke himself. Therefore, he lost this common point of contact that he was searching for. As the years went by, Dan started experimenting with other different approaches for keeping up this search for an overall orientation of his different individual pieces. This has been expressed mostly in political theoretical articles that he has integrated in the form of prefaces and conclusions in his more collective volumes and other collective writings. And as the years went by, I think that the eventual collapse of the Soviet bloc and the role that democracy played there showed that we have some resources of this kind, and that these have appeared through the guise of democracy. And therefore, this has given us a common ground that we can hope to re-explore and to hope to rework for our further personal and collective benefit. Also, another insight that he has brought up from his earlier work has to do with the fact that we should keep up the failures of the already established democracy up to present, which can be established that we always need to be effortful into reworking the democracy that we have received, and not to be hesitant into reshaping the way that we trust it and the way that we can hope to invent new ways on being democratic from now on, which is an outlook that he has adopted from his early work on Locke and his own bringing up to the mainstream attention of Locke's own failures in the writing, in his own writings, and in the division of his own personal intellectual design.
Right. I think that we are reaching towards the end here. I have two more questions, and they both are more general about the conclusion. I mean, the conclusions, you don't have a very expansive discussion in the conclusion, and it might be because you have rather extensive discussions of both Skinner and Dunn themselves in the individual chapters on these figures, but the overall conclusion is only 5 pages long, which is kind of short for this dissertation, I think. Basically, I think it works fine. You reintroduce Pocock and you discuss them, these theorists, from the perspective of method, discipline, and socio-political impact, or as you have done previously as well. I will not go through that again, but instead I want to return to a couple of issues that you flag in the introduction as the kind of main ambition of your thesis, which is to revisit the commonplaces that you talk about, like the commonplace of the Cambridge School as an ensemble of methodological formulas on the one hand, and the other cliche that you talk about is the relation between the individual authors and the school as a whole. So I'm kind of curious as to how you see yourself revising these commonplaces and what image you put in those commonplaces instead of these commonplaces. Are you kind of providing a more complex image of two separate individual authors? Are you kind of dissolving the Cambridge School from within? or do you still want to kind of keep a notion of some kind of united Cambridge School? I also like ask the same question from a kind of historical perspective. Do you think that Skinner and Dunn grew apart or grew together if you take it from the 60s until today? Have they become more similar or more diverse? Or have they kind of grown together or have they grown apart? And yeah, this relates to the question of whether there is a Cambridge School still.
Thank you very much for your questions, which actually raise points that I would be interesting to answer in terms of more individual questions, but I will try as always my best in order to respond to the different shades that you have introduced in our discussion. I think that one of the issues that you have brought up to the fore has to do with the fact on how my small general conclusions that you have kindly presented as being on a good condition for my entire project have been meant to implicate in what has to do with our understanding of the Cambridge School. I would say that in the first place I tried to keep them short because I wanted to keep up a more open-ended horizon for the Cambridge School. This has to do with the fact that I did not go as analytical as I would like with Pocock. Therefore, a generalization of the Cambridge School in more exhaustive terms might probably create a rather distorted picture, since it would leave Pocock outside. Therefore, I tried to keep things as terse as possible. I tried to keep up the basic conclusions that I brought up in my chapter on Skinner and Dunn, and to show how my readings of Pocock's work up to now would allow for an approximation of seeing Pocock's works from a similar point of view. In case we manage to get as clearly and carefully comparative with the three authors, we can hope to achieve a more carefully elaborated overall framework of what we can count as the Cambridge School. In this respect, I try, as you quite rightly point out, to return to some of the clichés against which I have been expressing my worries at the beginning of this dissertation. And as far as the people who are interested to draw interest from the methodology of the Cambridge School are concerned, I do not want to stop this kind of interest. Quite much on the contrary, I think that this is a quite legitimate interest to draw from the Cambridge School. However, I am worrying that this kind of people might be losing what has been brought about in between from these original articles up to present. This is an issue that I try to cover in the intermediate chapters, which also allow me to generalize on Skinner's and Dunn's work in more careful terms than those that are provided in those early accounts. Therefore, people who are interested to take up the methodology of the Cambridge School as it is usually learned can do this in multiple ways by reading my work. They can either read Skinner's and Dunn's chapters as well as my introductory chapter in more careful terms in case they want to get the full picture of what Skinner and Dunn are doing, whereas in case they want a more comprehensive picture that can help them apply such insights in their own research in more accessible terms, they can probably turn to the general conclusion in this form or in the more elaborate form that I will hopefully deliver as soon as I work on Pocock as well, since I believe that in the way that I have organized things in this general conclusion, I make it easier for people to combine the different insights that they find in the different writings of Skinner's, Tan's, and Pocock's work, and show how this can be matched with each other without creating apparent and quite strong contradictions. This is an effort to create some concord in the different insights that are usually taken to be valuable on the Cambridge School, and that I have found valuable by myself by reading the work of these authors in analytical terms. In this respect, you have also brought up a question of whether I try to encourage something like the setting apart of the Cambridge School author or leading the different readers to see them as a complete school. Well, I would say that I try to keep up all options open. I believe that the way that I individualize the work of different authors as carefully as possible can allow for people who are interested to stick mostly to Skinner's approach, to Dan's approach, and to what I will hopefully present one day as Pocock's approach, can draw benefits out of getting more expert on how to work as these authors have been advising us, by sticking to the more individual chapters of my dissertation. On the other hand, people who are interested to bring up the general picture or to draw insight from more than one of these authors can stick into viewing them as the Cambridge School as a whole, or as some more perhaps Skinner-oriented, Dan-oriented, Pocock-oriented version of the Cambridge School. This can allow them to keep up the general picture if they wish, as well as to combine this approach of the Cambridge School or of the individual authors with other approaches such as the Begriffsgeschichte and so on. And you have also brought up an additional question which has to do with whether I believe that, let's say, Professor Dan and Professor Skinner have been leading diverting ways or not. I believe that this is a matter of perspective, more or less. They can be seen as being confluent in various respects, since they share various contexts and that they have went on interacting with each other. They have been strongly reading each other's works, and you can see their insights even as the decades go by, even though the references are not so overt. However, I believe that the more general course that one can take, that the more general lesson that one can draw by reading the Cambridge School is that when we read other people, it is important to keep up our personal stand and our personal opinion in the process. Therefore, I believe that their working with each other does not necessarily make them fall apart or lead separate ways. What I take to be most instructive in the Cambridge School is that we can always keep up and work on our more personal voice, on our more personal standing in academics and beyond, can be possible without neglecting the need to engage in what I call an ongoing dialogue. This dialogue can be short, as I have shown in the more individual context that I have kept up for the footnotes of the main chapters, or it can be a more constant one, as the case has been between the different Cambridge School authors and the different kinds of influences that they have been introducing, as I try to show in my more introductory chapter, in what has to do with the different influences in the original making of the school, as well as by appealing to the work of Max Weber and how this has been present throughout the work of the two authors. I hope that this resolves part of your question.
Perfectly okay. The final question is about conceptual history, the thing that we started with, or in which you start the whole dissertation with. We have not talked about the relationship between the Cambridge School and Begriffsgeschichte, and you make some references in the dissertation. I don't want you to recap those now. Instead, I want to ask a question about the field of conceptual history in general, where it is going now. This is my personal view. If I look at the latest publications in the European conceptual history series and so forth, the Willibald Steinmetz, Michael Frieden, and so forth, it seems to me, and this is my personal reflection, that the role of the Cambridge School is fading within conceptual history today. Its role is, I think, we see a recoselectification of the field of conceptual history. So my question is, do you agree with this? Why do you think this is the case, if you agree? And most importantly, given your work on the Cambridge classics, what is lost from conceptual history if we forget about the Cambridge school? This is my final question.
Well, thank you for this final question, which has been probably the most surprising one up to now. Well, I would like to thank you for this approach and for this personal point of view on where conceptual history is going. I would like to let you know that I come from a quite different background. I do not view myself that much as a conceptual historian. My own education and my own sympathies tend mostly to the Anglophone education, and therefore I view myself mostly as a historian of political thought and a historian of ideas. However, I quite much enjoyed the dialogue that conceptual history has allowed between this mode of working and some perspectives that have gained currency in continental Europe and other places of the world. And therefore, by appealing to conceptual history, I have tried to keep up this dialogue open. I have tried to show that both ways can draw benefits. I have tried to show that both what the Cambridge School has been doing can be insightful and can count as conceptual history. This is why I mostly focus on the individual histories of concepts and ideas here. I try to show that quite a strong part of what these authors have been doing can count as conceptual history or history of ideas, working on similar preconditions as those that present-day identifiable conceptual historians have using. And therefore, I wanted to keep up this mode of interest. Also, I want to show that what the Cambridge School and the people who mostly stick to the Anglophone education have been doing can still draw insights from the more strictly speaking conceptual history approaches. I believe that this is a dialogue that should go on and should remain open. In this respect, my humble view is that Begriffsgeschichte and conceptual history should not that much be identified. I think that the Begriffsgeschichte idiom sticks quite much to what Koselleck and other German successors have been mostly doing. Nowadays, conceptual history, as we see it, for instance, in the journal Contributions to the History of Political Concepts and to many other journals, seems to have a fate similar with that with the one that Dan has portrayed for democracy. It seems to be quite much domesticated on the different local settings that have been produced. This is a future that I would like to see to prosper in what has to do with conceptual history, and this is why I bring up the Cambridge School back. I believe that conceptual history can self-indigenize itself in the different geographical settings, and this is an exercise that I would like to see getting more encouraged. And therefore, this is why I would like them to stick, I would like the more strictly speaking conceptual historians to go on reaping benefits from the Cambridge School. I would also like to say that with some bitter disappointment, I tend to see the opposite view. Also, the Cambridge School intellectual historians are not always that strongly drawn to Koselleck anymore. So perhaps your sentiment that the conceptual historians no longer have an interest in the Cambridge School can be reversed and can be seen from the opposite way as well. I believe, however, that this is a matter of perspective and that we do not have to be so much of pessimists. Perhaps the reason that you see that the conceptual historians do not draw so many insights from the Cambridge School anymore has to do with the fact that the Cambridge School journals have proliferated in the recent years, whereas the conceptual historians network that study in Koselleckian terms has also proliferated in terms of the quantity of the scholars that work on this approach. So they tend to organize their own conferences or to prefer their own journals where they can mostly read each other. This is natural. This is part of the academic specialization that is always underway. However, I believe that what is more important is to keep up the points of connection between the different disciplines and not to miss the importance of stressing the way to keep up a dialogue between perspectives that have proven to be telling for authors that have an education that can be broad enough to integrate both approaches. So in order to answer your questions on what, strictly speaking, conceptual historian historians can draw from the Cambridge School. I can once again draw up from in the different methodological devices that have proven to be telling from the different Cambridge School classics that I have brought up here. I believe, for instance, that Skinner has been individualizing the authors in much more careful terms than the Kozelekian conceptual historians have been doing. Kozelek has been tending to making some narratives that tend to have also some ready-made boxes for the different individual authors, as one can tell, for instance, from the way that he tries to put authors into some schemes in his History of the Concept of Crisis. I believe that Skinner, in individualizing the authors and their more particular contexts, can give us a more careful level of detail, whereas I would not say that the interest in context has been lost in conceptual historians. I believe that the very term context appears everywhere, even in conceptual historians. Perhaps this is more or less my personal view, but this is an approach. Also, Pocock's concepts of implications are still present in conceptual histories, I would say, and that they can be more telling when studying concepts, since concepts are features in human speech that persist beyond individual voices. They can be seen as having implications beyond individuals par excellence. So implications can be a term that can be of particular use in conceptual history. Whereas what Dan can give us is the need to keep up some more balanced accounts, as I believe that the case has certainly not been with Kozelek. Kozelek, in my view, has overemphasized some more German sources, and therefore I believe that the way Dan has been working with picking up some more moderate and more Anglophone sources can keep up some missing emphasis there, whereas people can draw similar kinds of lessons by generalizing these features, by lessons on how to combine the different disciplines and how to keep up some more sociopolitical matters of relevance, as I would say that is certainly the case with the growing histories of concepts of democracy and republicanism that go on being produced up to present. This being so, I take this to be the greatest piece of evidence that what the Cambridge School has been offering, especially with the sociopolitical emphasis on republicanism and democracy, has been nowhere from absent from the strictly speaking conceptual historians. And I hope that perhaps our readers and the audience can agree on this.
Thank you. So keeping up the dialogue between intellectual centers is, I believe, the role of marginal places like Finland in the intellectual republic. So in that sense, I think that Jyväskylä and the interest in conceptual history here is very much, very much welcome. So, in writing this manuscript, Konstantinos Bizas has undoubtedly done a massive work. Most impressive to me is the sheer amount of literature that he has plowed through. Because in order to do a study of this type, you need to master not only the works of Skinner and Dunn themselves and the literature on them and their interpretations, but also the sources that they have used and the secondary literature that they themselves discuss. So in writing the thesis, Bizas has been forced to keep all these four balls in the air at the same time, something that he mostly does with great self-confidence. It's a colossal amount of literature. The thesis also covers political discussions on political thought from ancient Greece, Roman times, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, Age of Reformation, as well as political theory from the 19th and 20th century. Indeed, up until the end of history and beyond. As such, Konstantinos Bizas has clearly shown that he is a very civilized and well-educated young man. The dissertation also comes as a welcome addition to the scholarly literature. The Cambridge School has inspired a whole generation of scholars, but it has not itself been the subject of this kind of scrutiny before. The dissertation consists partly of a historical contextualization of the Cambridge School, but mainly of a minute discussion and systematization of the main works of Quentin Skinner and John Donne, an anatomatization of their argumentative method, according to Bizas himself, which to me is a very apt description of his work, anatomization. Somewhat surprisingly, perhaps, Biza focuses less on the theoretical basis of the Cambridge School in the sense of contextualization, speech as theory, rhetoric, and more on the overall structure of the arguments of Skinner and Dunn and their categorizations of historical positions and the way that they draw their conclusions from their categorizations. Although a bit surprising, perhaps, this it is also in this minute and detailed anatomization that the originality of the work lies. Bezos is also able to use this anatomization in order to identify gaps and contradictions in the argumentation of Skinner and Dunn. I particularly enjoyed the observation that Skinner seems particularly disinterested in the development of the historical discipline, although he uses history to hammer points against home points against politics and philosophy. That said, it is not as if we have agreed on everything either. My most substantial critique pertains to the fact in which Bezos consciously or unconsciously portrays Skinner as a flawed or incoherent theory builder, which in my view conflicts with Skinner's own explicit perspectivist agenda. But we don't need to agree on everything. That would be boring. I have also pointed out some points in the manuscript that I believe that should be improved if this would be developed to a book. Most of all, I would urge the author to flesh out the introduction and the conclusions in order to make his own original points more clear to the reader. And the parts are also a bit asymmetrical, with the Skinner part written periodically and the Dunn part chronologically. And then there is the notable and accentuated absence of Pocock. And an international publisher would probably also want to do something with the general presentation in order to make the book a bit more accessible. That said, and to sum up my evaluation of the work, it's beyond doubt that Bezos masters the discipline, and his expertise on the Cambridge School is nothing short of impressive. I learned a lot from reading this. Most of all, he has clearly shown today that he can present and defend his views, also orally. We have not agreed on anything, but that's not the aim either. A world without contestation and different interpretation would be a dull place. It's therefore my great pleasure to recommend to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Jyväskylä to accept Konstantinos Bezos' manuscript as a dissertation for the degree of a PhD. Thank you.
Honored opponent, I wish to convey my sincere thanks for the valuable comments you have given on my dissertation. At this point, I solicit those who have critical comments regarding my dissertation to ask for the floor from the Kustos.
No phone calls have arrived. So I declare dissertation or defense of course of defense of his dissertation.
Thank you.